DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the news headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Samantha Early. With the world's attention firmly fixed on the US election, we look at how the campaign is viewed abroad and why that matters. Plus, what's at the root of the Philippines president's anti-American tirades and new independent foreign policy?
Today, it is a reality that we are no longer your little brown brothers. That may be true decades, centuries ago, but today we deserve to be treated well considering the geographical position, strategic position of the Philippines in Asia.
All of this and more coming up on Worldlink. You're listening to DW's Worldlink. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Samantha Early. It's America's time to choose the nationwide election with global consequences. Who will be the next US president, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump?
Donald Trump is an entity that the German logical thinking method does not comprehend.
That's Thomas Leiser from Republicans Overseas, based in Germany.
I voted for Donald Trump, and I did that because I think the Republican Party has the proper philosophy on how to run the government and how to proceed. And I have a firm belief that if the Republicans maintain control of the House and Senate, there is a strong check involved in what the president can and cannot do.
As for the Democrats in Germany, Karen Schneider has been watching the campaign from afar with concern.
What I'm even more scared of is what other people who are the so-called Trump supporters, what they are planning to do if Trump is not elected. There's an awful lot of implied violence out there right now.
And this rift in society has caused concern across the world. And we're going from Americans abroad to Germans in America. Ines Pohl is DW's Washington, D.C. correspondent, and she's, of course, been closely following the campaign. I began by asking her why she thinks it's important to have an outsider's perspective in the race for the White House.
I mean, one big topic from Donald Trump is that he says, don't trust the mainstream media. The mainstream media are rigged because they have special interests. And he's talking about the US mainstream media. And sure, he overdoes it as he does everything. But there is a little bit of truth in it. The media seen in the United States is very polarized. If you watch MSNBC, this is a very liberal TV station. You know that they're only absolutely for Hillary Clinton, that they really supported Bernie Sanders early on. The same is true for Fox News, which is a really conservative news station. They used to be very close to the Republicans. So I think it's important for the American people to get kind of an outsider's perspective. And that's what we experienced on the road. Many, mainly Trump supporters said, no, we don't talk to American media anymore because they are biased. They don't report fairly about us. But when we said, hey, we are from Deutsche Welle, this is Germany's international broadcaster, they opened their doors and were really willing to share their perspective with us. So I think we are in a way more neutral and more free and probably also a little bit more curious to really try to understand how people feel and what they think about the candidates.
And you yourself went to Arizona to meet Trump supporters Jim Chilton and his wife Sue. We've got a clip from Jim.
It's a very poor excuse for an international boundary. I mean, it's laughable. It's hilarious to think that the United States boundary on my ranch is nothing but a four-strand barbed wire fence.
So you went to that fence. Tell us about that. What did Jim and Sue tell you about what they think of Trump's strengths and Clinton's weaknesses?
So we really wanted to do a piece with and on Trump supporters. And we wanted to do a piece with really smart people because it's easy to find kind of stupid Trump supporters and then they feed in all to your bias. But we really wanted to get to know some smart Trump supporters. So we found Jim and Sue. They own a huge ranch on the Arizona-Mexican border. we met them. We stayed with them, actually, for a night. So we really got to know these two people. They're two lovely people, highly educated. He was in politics. She's a school teacher. She actually teaches Spanish kids without papers. So they're very liberal in many regards, but they want the wall. They want a secured border to Mexico because they have thousands of drug traffickers crossing their land every year. So they have this one single issue why they want Donald Trump to become the next president of the United States. With Hillary Clinton, they just say she has been so long in the political business, she didn't help us. Washington doesn't help us. We are all left alone here on the border to Mexico. And our hope is Donald Trump as an outsider, that he's willing to really get things done. All of us found that really interesting. First of all, that these were so lovely, liberal, open-minded people. But then also, I really understood why you would want to vote for Donald Trump and why you would want a strong president who is just taking care of you.
And it's interesting that a lot of this campaign and what I see on social media as well is for a lot of people, it does come down to a single issue, whether it is immigration, whether it is abortion, a lot of things, it does come down to a single issue for people. How do you see that?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And this is a huge difference from Germany and maybe many other European countries. My thesis is the more complicated this world gets and the more complicated it gets to solve the real problems in economy, in safety, the more people are likely to focus on this one single issue to be able to make a decision whom they want to vote for.
And that's interesting because you're right. A lot of observers from the rest of the world can find that quite hard to fathom. I mean, what do you think have been the main issues that have been brought up in the campaign that have had the most impact on how people see America, how people see America's role and its standing in the world?
I mean, I think, the biggest impact probably is the figure Donald Trump himself. I mean, that's what I see, what many, many people from outside the United States ask me, how could this happen? What does it say about this country and the shape of this country and the shape of politics if a person like Donald Trump might become the next president of the United States? And after all, it's still possible. When it comes to content, I think one of the biggest topics is really international politics, the way Donald Trump is talking about NATO, for example. The big question, how will the next American president shape the relationship with Russia? This is really crucial for Europe. How will the next president handle conflicts like Syria? Will the next president become more of a war president again, as Bush and others did before? So I think it's really a question about war and peace.
Whatever path the US takes, the impact will be felt worldwide. And even though non-Americans don't have a vote in this election, we here think they should at least have a voice. So that's why, as well as Enos and the team traversing the US, DW reporters across the globe have been asking people this question: what kind of America do you want?
Mahmudul Hake Munshi from Bangladesh.
I want America to be more migrant-friendly America and to help those people who are coming to America from around the world. And I want America to cut ties with those countries who are supporting terrorism and terrorist-related organizations.
Sandy Chan from Hong Kong.
I want an America which has stricter gun control. The US is one of the most influential countries in the world. What we need there is not violence, but rationality and the will to improve. We have to understand the differences among people of different skin colors and races.
Muda Mahesh from India.
American people should believe in Trump. If Hillary wins, the middle class people of America are going to suffer a lot because there are not going to be any jobs. If Trump wins, he's going to give a better life for the middle class people of America.
Nura Umar from Nigeria.
I want America that will help Muslims all over the world. For example, to allow them to do whatever things they want to do according to their religion. Muslims are not terrorists.
Alexei Nikolov from Russia.
My hope is totally unrealistic one. I hope that one day America will become a country which cares more about other countries than about itself.
Cornelia Schmidt-Lehrmann from Argentina.
Espero que sea un Estados Unidos pacífico.
I am hoping for a peaceful America that signs important treaties and fulfills them, for example, regarding the environment or non-proliferation of weapons. And though it might sound weird, an America that further integrates into the world and bets on dialogue more than anything else.
Darina Tolkach from Ukraine.
The America I would like to see and I wanted to see is a free country, a democratic and free place where people can fulfill their rights. Nevertheless, I would like to see America being supportive to those who need the support.
Sheba Pariza Ibrahimi from Afghanistan.
I support Hillary Clinton because I'm critical about her opponents' views on extremism and migrants. I expect Clinton to help women around the world, especially in Afghanistan, where she can help Afghan women achieve the same in terms of good governance and better politics.
Shia Yulin from Taiwan.
In my view, the United States is actually an economically powerful country, but in recent years there have been some economic problems and also issues with democracy. Overall, the US has become quite retrograde. I hope that the US economy gets back on track and that then the other Asian countries and also Taiwan get better.
Oleg Sirota from Russia.
I'd like to have America under the leadership of Donald Trump, a man who brings back traditional values like family and bans same-sex marriage and abortion. And I want America to be a country we can compete against.
You're listening to DW's WorldLink with me, Samantha Early, and I'm turning back to Enos Paul, DW's Washington correspondent, about the US election. Enos, during this campaign, it's been really interesting to see the scandals and the muckraking and the things that have been revealed about both candidates. And here in Germany, just one of those accusations could ruin a politician's career for good. So how do you explain that Clinton and Trump have been able to come through so many scandals, so many accusations, and yet still, here they are?
I think that that has a lot to do with both of them because, you know, neither Hillary Clinton nor Donald Trump is really liked by the people. Donald Trump only came so far because so many people hate Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton only is still in the race because so many people think Donald Trump would be the worst what could happen to this country.
Is this one of those only in America things? Because, you know, I just look in Germany of examples like Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. His political career was basically ended because of plagiarism of a doctorate. Whereas Trump, there's been a scandal with a whole university, Trump University. I mean, how do you explain that to people back home?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, Germany is full of these examples. A president, you know, had to step down Christian Wolff because of really minor reason, and other politicians. Why is it possible in the United States? I think this has a lot to do with the system that we only do have two parties. And this is also has a lot to do with the system of the primaries, that this is such an ongoing process. I mean, the whole year was dominated by this election campaign. And that the networks, you know, can keep going. They kind of need these little scandals. And therefore, they want these little scandals. And in a way, they create these little scandals. In Germany, the media very early, for example, with von Gutenberg, really forced him to step down. Here, the networks kind of love this because they get, you know, they get the people to watch them, to follow them, to buy the newspapers. It's, after all, it's really a money machine. That is a difference. And then I also think sometimes back home in Germany, people are really hypercritical when it comes to politicians. And they want a purity which is just not possible for any average people, but most definitely not for people who have been in politics for so long.
So that's what Germans expect from their politicians. But what kind of America do they want? We took to the streets here in Bonn to ask that very question.
Okay, I want an America that's not like this America that you can see right now, like not a torn into populist sides. It's just sad to see.
I want an America where somebody like Donald Trump can't rise to power and can't be a presidential candidate.
I would like to have a strong America. However, it also needs to be like a role model for other countries. Open, liberal, open for immigrants and so on. And I don't see that in Trump.
Well, I would like a strong America, particularly because it's such a huge country. And I think it's really important for to general like stability within the world. So just as Europe is important, the US are just as important to just keep the world in itself peaceful and stable.
Well, first of all, I think America should actually step away from its idea of being a superpower, because obviously, financially speaking, it doesn't work as well as it used to do. Well, those times are over, more or less, and I would rather have a very humble, Western-oriented, moral America than the America we have today.
So let's end on the America we have today. I finished by asking Ines Paul what's baffled her the most this campaign.
I mean, I know the United States quite well. I've been here since 15 years on a very regular basis. I've been living here a couple of times, and I have to say, to see the anger and the hate of many Trump supporters when it comes to Hillary Clinton, that really scared me. And it's, again, a lesson what we all should take from this election. I am still a little bit shocked to see how easy people are willing to follow someone like Donald Trump.
Thanks to DW's Washington correspondent, Ines Paul. And to find our coverage of the US elections and to have your say, look up the hashtag WhatAmerica on social media and visit DW.com. We're sticking with the theme of US foreign policy now. The new president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, has been making headlines with his foul-mouthed tirades against the US. Duterte remains defiant and has spoken of downgrading the long-standing relationship between the US and its former colony. As Michael Sullivan reports, he's never been much of an America fan for a variety of reasons, including a mysterious bombing in Davao when he was mayor there.
It's a long walk up several flights of stairs to the Evergreen Hotel, and it's not really worth it. The hotel is way past its sell-by date. Even the printer behind the front counter is old, but the desk clerk's friendly, and the place has got history.
I'd like a room, please.
753.
And you have a sign on the wall that says strictly no smoking.
Yes, it's against the law.
What about making bombs in the room?
It's highly prohibited.
Highly prohibited. But it's been done before.
Yes, maybe.
Not maybe, definitely. On May 16th, 2002, according to the police report, when an American citizen, Michael Mehring, accidentally blew himself up with an explosive device he'd kept in a metal box in the room. Mehring was a self-described treasure hunter and had warned the hotel's staff not to touch the box.
He was not a friendly guy. We are just asking the boy, the bellboy, was he friendly? No. He was secretive.
That's Faye Bassan. She was the precinct commander at the police station just around the corner when the explosion occurred. She got there, she says, 5 minutes later.
So when we reached there was already a fire, but we forced to enter his room. Then we found him in the room with his leg already gone.
And did he say anything at the time?
No, because he was still unconscious because of maybe of the pain.
They rushed him to the hospital, planning on interrogating him later, but never got the chance because the next day, Mehring was gone. Taken from the hospital, officials here in Davao say, by shadowy U.S. operatives.
According to the doctor in the hospital, he was taken by men, at least four, wearing FBI T-shirts. Then he was flown by a chartered plane from Davao to Manila.
and from there out of the country, despite criminal charges pending against Mehring. And Mayor Duterte was furious, says this former high-ranking army intelligence officer who requests anonymity.
That is the beginning why Mayor Duterte, now the president, hate Americans. That's the very good reason.
Duterte has suggested Mehring may have had links to other bombings in Mindanao, and there's been talk linking him to the CIA at a time when the U.S. was bolstering its military presence in Mindanao as part of the post-9/11 war on terror. When asked about the Mehring affair, the U.S. Embassy sent an email that read in part, "We took no action beyond providing routine consular services assisting a U.S. citizen with a medical evacuation." The Mehring case may be one reason for Duterte's distrust of the U.S. Another, history.
He's not against the American people, but it's more of the policy. The injustice done to the Moros. Because his mother has her roots from the Muslim settlers of Mindanao.
Injustice, says Davao journalist Aditha Caduaya, against Moro Muslim insurgents that occurred during the U.S. occupation of the Philippines that began in 1898 and ended in 1946. In particular, the alleged massacre of hundreds, including women and children, on the island of Jolo in 1906.
When he recalls that incident, he usually rants.
Duterte has also made it clear he doesn't trust the U.S. to come to the Philippines' aid as a treaty ally if push comes to shove with China in the South China Sea. One of the reasons analysts in Manila say for his flirtation with China recently, famously announcing his separation from the U.S. while in Beijing, an apparent effort to repair relations that soured in recent years over China's aggressive territorial expansion in the South China Sea, pursuing what he calls an independent foreign policy, not being overly reliant on the U.S. Or as Duterte's foreign secretary, Perfecto Yaisai, put it recently, we cannot forever be the little brown brothers of America. Malu Takia of the consulting firm Publicos Asia says he's right.
Today, it is a reality that we are no longer your little brown brothers. That may be true decades, centuries ago, but today, we deserve to be treated well, considering the geographical position, strategic position of the Philippines in Asia.
The U.S., others argue, gives countries like Israel, Egypt, and Jordan billions, much of it for sophisticated weapons, while Manila gets 50-year-old hand-me-down Coast Guard cutters. And that bothers some like Dindo Manhit of the Albert Del Rosario Institute, a Manila think tank. He's asked U.S. officials about it.
And the only official or unofficial answer I get was, you're not ready. So the Middle East countries are better prepared than us. We're not ready. So it's really maybe Duterte is right that we have not been treated well in this relationship.
Maybe right about that, Manhit says, but wrong for Duterte to swing too far the other way toward China.
He's so fascinated by the idea of stronger economic relations with China without realizing the U.S. is our number two trading partner. Our country is driven by remittances. It's our consumption-based economy. 40% of that comes from the United States. Filipino-Americans, Filipino migrants there, sending back home. So why set aside that core relationship that helps this economy by simply saying, oh, China can do this?
Pride, history, oh. And getting rejected for that U.S. visa when he wanted to visit a girlfriend didn't help either. But Duterte needs to be careful, Manhit warns. A new poll shows nearly 8 out of 10 Filipinos still trust the U.S., and about the same percentage don't trust China. For DW, I'm Michael Sullivan in Manila.
And you're listening to DW's World Link with me, Samantha Early.
We're all living in America, America, it's wunderbar. We're all living in America, America, America. We're all living in America, Coca-Cola, sometimes war. We're all living in America, America, America.
You're listening to DW's WorldLink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. I'm Samantha Early in Bonn.
I was hiding like most of the time. I don't rent like a house in my name. I try always like to come back at home at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, because I know like I was in danger and they will not leave me alone.
We introduce you to a famous Syrian actor who's running out of places to hide. And we also look into a special form of palliative care, music for the dying.
I'm not improvising in the strict sense. I'm not going where I think the music is going to take me. The way I see it, the patient is improvising. And then my job is to accompany that.
These stories and more coming up on WorldLink. We hear in the news almost daily about the human tragedies caused by the war in Syria, from civilian bombing casualties to the plight of displaced Syrians in refugee camps to the heartbreaking stories of lives lost in the attempt to reach safety in Europe. And while conditions for Syrians in refugee camps and those trying to get to Europe may be well documented, there are thousands more unregistered Syrians who've fled their homeland to nearby Lebanon. Having already made a documentary in Lebanon's refugee camps, the Lebanese-French director Dima Al-Jundi wanted to make a new film which would give people an insight into another group of Syrian exiles. She chose to focus on the lives of three Syrian performers working as dubbing artists. One of the protagonists is a famous Syrian actor, Orwa Kalthum, who travelled over from Beirut with the director to present the film at its first screening in Italy. Danny Mitzman's been finding out more about his exceptional story with an unexpected final twist.
I was living in Damascus, in a very good neighborhood. Everything, it was okay for a while. And then, I have to move.
What made you think, I've really got to leave this country? My country.
It started to be dangerous for me.
In what way?
As an artist, famous artist, of the beginning, they try to ask me to go to TV and speak.
So they were asking you to do propaganda?
Yeah, sure, a lot. But I refused that. So they stopped me from university. I was a teacher for 5 years, acting and technical vocals. So they kicked me out from university.
What is it that's so dangerous to the regime in artists?
Because, artists always, they have a loud voice. Because, you are not far from people. People, they love you. They move with you, when you start, to be bigger and bigger and bigger. So, they can ask you, what do you think about that? And especially as a teacher in university. So I was having, a lot of students. So, and it's more danger for them. Then I was an owner for a big restaurant. It was the number one in Damascus.
It was there that Orwa Kulthum suffered his first attack when someone tried to shoot him.
When you said no as an artist, and I didn't agree with the regime, so they start to give you stuff as a shabiha. Shabiha, it's gang working for regime. They tried to kill me two times. They tried to kidnap me one time. I didn't have a choice to live. It was I have to live.
On the 21st of July 2012, Orwa drove his car the 115 kilometres from Damascus to Beirut, leaving the fame and fortune he'd garnered behind him.
Lebanon, I stayed there for 4 years and a half. I was hiding most of the time. I don't rent a house in my name. I try always to come back at home at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, because I know I was in danger and they will not leave me alone.
For 3 years, Orwa kept his head down. Unable to work legally in Lebanon, he got a cash-in-hand job as a chef at a friend's restaurant. Away from the stage and screen, the only acting work he accepted was as a dubbing artist for a meager $3 a scene. The Syrian accent is considered standard Arabic, understood by all Middle Eastern countries. The demand for Syrian dubbers and their exploitation in Lebanon captured the interest of Lebanese-French documentary maker Dima Aljoundi.
What you don't know here in Europe is that we were invaded by old Turkish cities like Harim Sultan during the Ottoman period, like other modern cities. All the women at home, they watch it, and it's dubbed with Syrian accents.
ليكي ديما بترجاكي تسكتي شوي وتسمعيني لحظة. ما صار هيك شيء بالمرة. جهاد ما عرف شيء. ما بيعرف عن الرسالة بنوب. طيب شو بيصير إذا بترجاكي؟
ديما had already made a documentary in Lebanon's refugee camps.
We were discussing about doing something from a complete new original point of view, which is Syrian actors surviving in Lebanon, what I call the middle class. I used to meet all Syrian artists around me as well, writers, painters, you know. So I see how they live, I see how they suffer, I see how lost they can be. And I wanted to talk about Syrian artists, not only refugees in the camps.
Dima, ما قدري تحكي لك شيء.
ايه هلا بدك تقولي نفس الشيء اللي قلتي لي بس تيك تو.
اوكي. من البداية حبيت احكي معك بس ما قدرت.
So the idea started, let's make a film about Syrian actor dubbing Turkish series. But this was an excuse to do something else, basically. The film is not about how they dub. The film is about entering the life of each of my characters in their suffering, in their joy, in their fun time, in their residency problems, in everything.
Echoes of the Shadows tells the stories of Orwa and two fellow Syrian artist musicians scraping a living in Beirut using their vocal talents. The documentary gives a sense of the protagonists' intense nostalgia for their homeland and the family and friends they've left behind. It paints a picture of a new life of complications, contradictions, and injustices.
The message before anything is a humanitarian message. I have all my life fought for human rights, democracy, and freedom of expression. Of course, I'm against the dictatorship in Syria, and I wanted to show what this... What are the result of this dictatorship on various levels? The result is exile, is loneliness, is suffering, is hunger, is all these issues that people are not aware of when their life is going very well. They had a good life and then they lost this good life, and that's what I wanted to express through them. I mean, Arwa had his own restaurant. He was making money, he was a star. He was doing theater, he was doing TV series. He was famous, and suddenly in 24 hours, oops, all is gone.
Mama, كيفك حياتي؟ كيفك يا روحي انت؟ شو اخبارك؟
انا منيح، انت كيفك يا ماما؟
الحمد لله، الحمد لله، كله تمام.
Making the documentary with Dima rekindled Orwa's need to express his voice through acting. Last year, he accepted a role in a TV series about the Syrian revolution, playing a school teacher in the city of Dara who helps the wounded in hospital and joins the Free Army.
Ihab wal bint w Fatma sallon shi. W lak Omar. Ihab w Fatma wal bint sallon shi. W lak ahki. W lak ahki. Am bil lak ahki. W lak ahki. Ahki. Lak ahki.
In the meantime, life in Lebanon has been getting worse for its uninvited guests.
What you should know is that on 4 million Lebanese inhabitants, we have almost 2 million, which is half of the population almost, of Syrian refugees. So yes, there is major racism increasing now. Like you can see signs in certain villages, horrible signs. It reminds me during the Holocaust when they used to put the Jewish star on the arms of all the Jewish just to recognize them. And now they put signs, Syrian are not allowed to go out on the street after 8 p.m. I can't accept this in my country. This is beyond racism. This is starting to try to put them like in a small jail, you know. So this situation is really tough. And lots of Syrians are feeling this pressure and want to leave. They are suffocating.
Thank you. invited to Italy to present Echoes of the Shadows together with Dima at the Terra di Tutti Film Festival, Orwa was met at Beirut Airport with an unexpected postscript to the documentary's story.
Just like I discovered like an airport, like I can't come back to Lebanon. You are not stupid. We know who's controlled the airport. So after like what I did in the series, they think like I'm a danger for them also in Lebanon. So they told me don't come back.
And if you do?
They will take me to Syria, for sure.
A very poignant scene is the very last scene when your voice comes in and you are talking about the three protagonists of your film and you say, I wonder who's going to be the first who will go off to the cold west, further away from Syria, who will be the first? And then coming to present the film at this festival, you've had your answer quite brutally, which is very emotional for you. It's making you cry now.
I feel guilty a little bit, you know, it's as if I predicted this. I felt that Arwa is among the three who's having most of the problems, but I didn't predict that this will happen to him. And every time I see the last scene, I feel really guilty. And Mamma Mia, I wish I didn't ask this question, you know, as if when I ask it, it happened.
But Orwa is philosophical about this unexpected new chapter. Now seeking political asylum in Italy, he feels his destiny has brought him to Bologna, where he plans to return to the theatre and start spreading his message for peace. Still wary of saying too much, lest there be repercussions for his family, he hopes one day he'll be able to return to his homeland, to a democratic Syria. Danny Mitzman for DW in Bologna.
For those who are dying, the transition to life's ultimate exit can often be quite a frightening experience. Now, a subspecialty of palliative care, music thanatology, is bridging the gap between life and death, using live harp music at the bedsides of people who are dying as a form of pain relief. So what effect does this prescriptive process have on patients, as well as on the family and friends who surround them in their final moments? Well, reporter Joel Carnegie heads to Journey Care, a palliative and hospice care centre in Chicago, the USA, to sit beside one of the dying patients to find out.
Some people really like it.
I was tuning upstairs and one of the nurses was like, oh, it's just like so relaxing, just this.
And you're just tuning.
This is Tony Peterson and Margaret Pasquale. Tony is president of the International Music Thanatology Association, and both he and Margaret have worked together as music thanatologists in Chicago for a number of years.
Margaret and I come in when patients are experiencing pain and symptom management issues, when their death is imminently approaching, and we're bringing in music to address these physical manifestations of the dying process, connecting music with things like breath and pulse and temperature.
Tony, can you come here? I need to talk to you.
Today, Margaret and Tony are going to play for a patient who has been seriously ill for a long time and is very close to dying.
Well, they're still doing the dressing. We were going to need that one.
There's a certain aspect of not knowing what we're going to encounter.
At this stage, I can't really say what might unfold in the room. In my mind, we spend so much of our lives being fearful of death and trying to avoid it at all costs. So when finally confronted by it, are our actual experiences as scary as what we think it might? And how can music make a difference?
So we're going to bring the harps in and play for this gentleman who is approaching the end of life. He's not really responsive, but we'll be watching his breathing. He looks fairly peaceful right now. I just got the family member in a comfy chair situated next to the bed. We've tuned the harps. It'll tend to be kind of a quiet and meditative endeavor, I would think.
As we go into the patient's darkened room, Margaret and Tony talk me through the process of what they call a music vigil, when patients are in their final hours.
I walk into a room and people sometimes just look at the harp and go, ah. Oh. Just the sight of it is sometimes relaxing to people because, I mean, it's a beautiful wooden sculpture. Before I even play a note, it changes the atmosphere in the room. If I'm going into an intensive care unit and there's all these machines and bells and whistles of modern medicines, it's important to sometimes bring a little beauty and humanity into those situations.
A lot of times when I go to see somebody, the patient is not incredibly responsive, but I still introduce myself, let them know what I'm there to do. And then I check their pulse, and then I also watch their respiratory rate. I do a respiratory distress observation scale assessment, as well as a pain assessment. But then from then on, it's really a nonverbal medium.
So the pacing of the music is determined a lot of times by the pacing of their breathing, for example, or, you know, the range that a melodic line might cover, or the dynamic ebb and flow, or the use of harmonies. Any of these musical building blocks are employed based on what we're seeing with these physical parameters in the patient.
So everything that we do is clinically based. It's not, we're not just out there sort of intuiting, well, I feel that you might, you know, need a little, I don't know. I get to make clinical choices based on the education I've been given and then the observations that I make.
I'm not improvising in the strict sense. I'm not going where I think the music is going to take me. The way I see it, the patient is improvising. And then my job is to accompany that.
It's interesting when people start to actively die, regardless of what their diagnosis has been, there's certain symptoms that come up, especially in the last days and hours of life. So issues of shortness of breath, dyspnea, physical pain issues, terminal restlessness, which often it can be that they're seeing things that we can't see, and they might do things like they reach up or they reach out. They're sort of between here and there, if you will. At the end of life, people can do a noisy sort of breathing called agonal breathing, you know, where people go, you know, it's loud, it can be congested, and it can worry the family, especially if it's going on and on and on. But we try to hold the patient and the family, whoever's present for that music vigil, with the music and allow them to have their own individual experience.
The music is often as comforting for the families and friends who visit as it is for the patient.
So sometimes people will fall asleep, or sometimes tears come, like they'll cry, and the music just sits with them and holds them. So the music follows the family as well as the patient. So it's a really contemplative medium.
Given the enormous difficulty of confronting death, our universal fear, Margaret says that it's perhaps the universality of music that makes it so mollifying.
It's hard. We're not working with a marginalized population. We're all going to die, you know, so it's facing that on a regular basis. We know music affects us emotionally and spiritually. You know, it's involved in all the movies that we see. It's involved in any church service or mosque service or anything you go to. So the idea that music could alleviate physical suffering was a big draw for me. And then I figured out I had to learn the harp, and I was like, are you kidding me? Like, harps at the bedside of the dying? How ridiculous, you know? But now I'm really convinced.
Music teacher and close family friend Sandra has also joined us in the room to support her dying friend throughout the vigil process.
You're sitting in a room with a friend of yours who you've known for a very long time. So what sort of runs through your mind as you're listening to the music, given this the situation that you find yourself in?
My friend was very soothed by this. I could see the expression. I have shared a lot of music with him over the years, and music is very important in both our lives, and I found it very relaxing and beautiful. This time of the year, it's kind of sad because of the leaves falling and things dying. Listening to the music was very uplifting, and I feel that this is something that I will remember always. I just hope that he's able to relax enough to let go now, because as my mother said when on her deathbed, she said it's hard to be born and it's hard to die.
But for Margaret Pasquale, she feels so fortunate to be able to bring music to people in these difficult moments.
When we're with people and there's a lot of emotion, it's there because they love the person. You know, and so, because people ask, a lot of people in hospice, how can you be around, you know, so much grief? And the reality is we're around a lot of love. You know, it's almost more sad when people aren't emotional. So I think that being around all that love is inspiring.
Joel Carnegie brought us that report from Chicago.
We live in a globalized world. Events in Africa and Asia impact on Europe. Decisions in Europe have knock-on effects in South America. The situation in the Amazon rainforest concerns us all. For more on global issues and the people behind them, visit dw.com/english/global3000. Global 3000 is DW's TV magazine exploring the opportunities and risks of globalization.
We now come to a new WorldLink segment. Our correspondent Tamsin Walker will be contributing a regular column from Berlin in future. These very personal columns will provide an insight into the oddities and idiosyncrasies of German life and culture that are often lost on the Germans themselves. And Tamsin's first installment takes a closer look at German multiculturalism. Now, of all the cultural groups that make up the melting pot Berlin is steadily becoming, one of the least mentioned is the Vietnamese. They make up a little over 1% of the population, largely in the former East, where they first arrived back in the days when the city was divided by its infamous wall. And quite often, you'll find them behind the counter of the city's flower shops, at which, as Tamsin Walker is all too aware, they offer more than mere bunches of dahlias.
Word is, I'm putting on weight. How do I know? Well, not because my jeans are getting too tight or because I've been sneaking a peek on friends' bathroom scales, but because I have a profound love of flowers. Okay, so I'm going to go and buy myself some flowers from my very favourite flower shop, which is called Blumen and Pflanzen. Actually, it looks like it's closed. Oh, no, there's a sign on the door, says open. Ah, it is.
Hello, guten Tag. Wie geht es dir, Schatz?
Gut, danke, dir?
Und ja, ich danke mir auch. Und möchtest du heute, was möchtest du denn?
Good question. What do I want today? While I cast my eye over the colourful collection of vases, I can feel her casting hers over me. I settle for a bunch of brilliant red and yellow dahlias. She tells me I'd be better off with two bunches, since it's the weekend. I'm not sure of the logic there, but I tell her I'll take two.
Wunderbar!
But I'm not quite finished yet. And neither, it seems, is she. And there it is. I'm getting fat. I have it direct from the source. My florist.
Ich bin dicker geworden.
Really? I ask her.
Yeah, schöner, sehr schöner Figur.
The first time she said it was a few months ago, and I was as dismayed as I was crushed. I even opened my shirt, and yes, I was wearing a vest underneath, to show her how wrong she was. She just smiled. The next time I crossed her threshold, sucking in my stomach and my cheeks as far as I could, I was floored to hear her hit me with the same verdict. This time, though, she assured me it was a good thing, insisting that in Vietnam, weight gain is generally indicative of health and happiness. That made me realize how little I know about the traditions and indeed history of Berlin's 12,000-strong Vietnamese community, or communities, for theirs is a tale of two halves. In the late 1970s, some 40,000 Vietnamese boat people fleeing repression and economic hardship were granted asylum in the former West Germany. Some ended up here, where they were given residency, language classes, access to education, training, and the social welfare system. But on the other side of the wall, things played out differently. In the 9 years preceding the collapse of East Germany, the socialist state recruited 60,000 Vietnamese contract workers on the basis that they would not become integrated, but would work hard and return home after 5 years. But when the war came down in November 1989, other opportunities hovered on the horizon. Around half the workers who'd come by invitation decided not to go back to Vietnam, but sought ways to stay, including applying for asylum. It was a long process, but gradually those who'd stuck out the uncertainty secured the right to live and work in the reunited Germany. Many set up on their own, selling fruit and veg, Asian specialities, clothing, or indeed, plants and flowers. Back in the store, which like many Vietnamese flower shops is quite simply called Blumen und Pflanzen, the florist tells me she likes the name. If you walk past here, you know we're selling plants and flowers, she says. In other words, she says things like they are. As we chat, she pulls out her phone to show me photos of her daughters. Aren't they beautiful? She says. She's right, they are. And then she zooms in on one of them wearing a skimpy swimming costume. Look at her figure! Let's just say it's impossible not to. I take my flowers and wander home, seeking comfort from the fact that I am clearly healthy and happy.
When we were younger, we thought everyone was on our side. Then we grew a little and romanticized the time. I saw flowers in your hair. It takes a boy to live, takes a man to pretend he was there. So then we grew a little and knew a lot, and now we demonstrated it to the cops. And all the things we said, we were self-assured. 'Cause it's a long road to wisdom, but it's a short one to being ignored.
A healthy and happy Tamsin Walker wrapping up this week's edition of Worldlink. We hope you enjoyed the show and will join us again next week for more personal stories from around the globe. You can always find the program or any individual reports at dw.com/worldlink. Look us up on SoundCloud or iTunes. And please do check out DW's brand new Global Society Facebook page for more related content. Worldlink was produced by Neil King and me, Samantha Early. Our sound engineer was Leonard Lippold. Worldlink was brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.